Welcome to the Spin Axis Podcast. I'm Eric Barzeski.
I'm Jason Nickel.
I'm Tyson Deskins.
I'm Dr. Sasha McKenzie.
You're with us today, Doc, to talk about something that Tyson and I talked about offline. The kinematic sequence is typically talked about as, before we get into that, actually, let's do this. What is the difference for listeners between the kinematic sequence and the kinetic sequence? I think people use those words interchangeably, and obviously they're not the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Kinematics refers to the description of motion, things like position, velocity, acceleration. Kinetics refers to what causes the motion or causes the change in motion, which is forces.
Okay.
Presumably, if you're talking about a kinetic sequence, you would see the forces that are expressed by muscles follow a certain pattern. Kinematics would be what you would observe with a camera system in terms of positions or velocities or when things change direction.
So is it fair to say the kinetics are what cause the kinematics?
Yep. 100%.
All right.
That's Newton's second law.
Right. So we're on to talk about in the kinematic sequence, we often say we want the pelvis to reach its peak rotational velocity first. Then we want the chest or torso to reach second. We want the arms to come third. And of course, we want the club to come last and ideally right around impact. Tyson and I were talking offline and we've seen about 40%. I look back through some of my gears captures and things where those middle two are flipped a little bit, where the arms reach their actual peak rotational speed before the chest or torso. And so we're having you on to talk about that. And then we're going to, if we have time, we're going to talk about some braking force stuff. But does the 40% number make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Coming from sports biomechanics background, I was a little bit, when I started getting into golf, I found it a little bit interesting that the kinematic sequence was specifically the order in which speeds peaked. In general, in sports, that's just like one version of it and not necessarily one that's emphasized if the end goal is to try and maximize the speed of a distal segment or something you're throwing or pitching or hitting. I would say that the transition sequence is what I would have learned and been educated on as being predominantly more important, not necessarily when the speeds of the segments peak. And I think this holds for golf. I'm much more concerned about the order in which things start to move in the downswing. But certainly TPI really popularized the idea that there should be a 1, 2, 3, 4 peaking of pelvis, torso, arm, club. I think what you're finding is true. If I look through a lot of the data collected by various AMM3D peak folks on tour players, yeah, maybe 40% have the 1, 2, 3, 4 sequence.
Yeah. When I first started to really start to pay attention to this, I was a little taken aback. I mean, even my plus handicap golfers that were coming in and I was measuring, you would see a lot of that. And then as I started to go back and try to look at some of the older data, you would even see that in some of the TPI graphs, but it was still sort of talked about as it needed to be 1, 2, 3, 4. I then started to look at some things like, well, how do we train one segment to speed up a little bit quicker? And there was really not anything out there to sort of look at. So, one of the big questions I would have for you, Doc, is like, let's just say a player has their peak velocity of their lead arm. So it makes sense to me now, after Eric and I talked about this, he was seeing some of the same things. I know he reached out to you and you sort of agreed with that. So it sort of calmed my perspective down a bit. One of the things that I see with, I'm going to be a little selfish here with myself, is my lead arm velocity is a little on the lower side, regardless of when it peaks. What could somebody do if they see, that their one of the segments peak velocity is maybe a little lower than what the averages would sort of show us they need to be? So for example, it's really hard for me to get my lead arm peak velocity above 750 degrees per second.
Okay.
And like I've had a little bit of a lead shoulder issue for the last 20 years. Is that a physical issue? Is that something that a player could train to speed up? Like, what would your opinion on that be?
Yeah. The first question I would ask is, what's your club head speed? And do you want it to be faster? That's the overarching theme you need to apply to this is, if we're trying to generate the absolute most speed possible, then you probably want a 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe I don't even know if that's necessary, but you probably want it. So, you know, I think the world record club head speed's 172 miles per hour right now.
That's
so
crazy.
Right. And so, that means even, you know, a lot of people say, well, this person is in 1, 2, 3, 4, and they're really fast. They swing at 125. And then I'll always bring up, you know, I used to use James Olowski, but we can talk about Kyle Burschire. We could talk about any long drivers. How many different sequences could they have been swing at 125? Mm. You know, when they can swing at 160, you know, not sure the absolute fastest guy, right? So I would say you're like, all right, well, my lead arm can't get over 750 degrees per second. You know, is your 7-iron going at 95 miles an hour? Because that's going to be a little bit faster than Victor Hovland, and he's doing okay.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, to me, before I would even get into any, you know, sequence stuff, or if it's for speed, then I would say, do you need more speed? Then I would say, okay, let's look at what we can do to get your 7-iron from 86 to 92. And if there was something in the sequence that looked pretty far off from normal, then we could attack it. But I'd say, you know, trying to just increase your arm speed, you know, it might not be the ticket. For example, pelvis speed is often talked about, but females have higher pelvis speeds on average than males at the professional level, you know, and then the closer you get to the club, the correlations start to go up a little bit. You know, it's still not I think we're looking at like 0.6, a correlation of 0.6 arm speed to club speed. So there's a lot of other things that can go into generating high club head speed. I'd want to look at other things before I'd say you should speed up the arms, because speeding up the arms might slow down the club.
Yeah, 100%. And so, like, as I'm listening to that, again, it's almost one of those, how often would an instructor sort of use the kinematic sequence to dive into something with a player? They're looking at the data first, from the video, from a launch monitor. What does the player want? We're not teaching via the kinematic sequence. It can be another tool in our toolbox.
Yeah.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. I think you have to start with what's the issue with ball flight.
Yeah.
And then, you know, okay, as opposed to, hey, I can improve ball flight if I improve this.
Yeah.
You know, like just as a general thought, I think that too many instructors went down that path maybe 10 years ago where it was like, right, well, let's take a look at the sequence. We got this PDF report, and it looks like you're not the right order. If we improve that, you will definitely get better at golf. I don't think that's true. You know, I looked at lots of players who, you know, didn't have 1, 2, 3, 4, and they won 2 majors a season. Yeah. And you're like, okay. Yeah. And you know, it's hard to imagine how they would get better by improving that sequence. I don't see the connection.
Yeah.
You know, now it's to me, though, it's very rare to find people that don't have the right transition order. Like, and even so, like, to me, that's more of a fundamental. Like,
yeah, let's talk about the transition order a little bit more, since,
yeah,
you know, you can do 1, 2, 3, 4 on the downswing, or you can do 1, 3, 2, 4. Those are pretty common. That covers what, 98% of good golfers?
Yeah.
You rarely see something other than that.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm guessing. Yeah. Okay, so in the transition, what's the order there? What do you see there that varies from bad players to good players, and so on?
Yeah, so to me, it's much more concrete that better players are 1, 2, 3, 4, pelvis, torso, arm, and then the club transitions in terms of changing direction. And even folks that are, you know, you don't have to be, but folks like, think of a classic example, KJ Choi, David Toms, they had a little bit of, you know, a toss, I wouldn't call it a cast, but they weren't really high speed players. So that was like, okay, you're probably sacrificing some speed. And then you've got guys that, you know, like Justin Thomas, Xander Schauffele, who when they're hitting, you know, smooth drivers, they kind of, you know, the wrist angle looks like it goes first. But then, and Rory to an extent has a lot of swings like that. But when you tell them, hey, I want 180 ball speed, that goes away. You know, they start to get back into that more standard 1, 2, 3, 4 sequence. And even if you do have a little bit of a toss out, it seems like that's like a pre-start to the swing. And then it goes, then you can see the, you know, everything else like re-engage when the wrists finally do open up. Like there's a little bit, it's not like a general opening the whole time with the wrist angle. It's like, oh, a little move. And it's like, all right, we're going to hold here. So it was like a fake little idiosyncrasy they had in their swing.
Yeah.
And to me, that when I look at a golfer, the first thing that I look at without a camera is my eyes always look at the lower body, something around the pelvis, hips. And as soon as that moves, as soon as I see that move in the transition, my eyes immediately go up to the club head. And if I can't see a crystal clear picture of the club head, if it's already blurry, then my gut is I don't like this swing so much. And you know, like some people will say, a perfect example of this, some people say, Chris Goddard, you know, like, I don't really like a swing, it's idiosyncratic. His is all, I look at him like, that guy's a player. His the lower body's gone. He's got so much patience up top. Like, there is a crystal clear image of that club. And in some cases, guys that are really fast, the club will still be moving in the backswing direction, lower body transitions. But if I look up and that's a blurry mess, the hands, the club, everything's just a blur up there, I don't even need a camera. I'm going to say, hey, we can probably clean up the transition a little bit. You're in a bit of a rush to hit the ball. I don't see that as being advantageous in any way. And you're probably putting more effort in than you need to get the level of club head speed. It's not a, you know, an absolute, but it's a high percentage of the time. That's a red flag for me.
When would we see, or when do you see, you know, the elite player, when does that pelvis line cross zero? What, obviously we're talking before the end of the backswing.
Yeah. Yeah.
How soon? P3 and a half.
Yeah. Varies a lot, but to me, it has to go before the club head and hands, you know,
okay.
That's just a general statement. And Chris Goddard has a ton,
right?
You know, before other guys have a little bit, and I don't even necessarily need to see rotation. It could be a little bit of a lateral shift.
Yeah.
Something has to go before the, you know, towards a target that suggests we've got this proximal to distal sequencing, which is common in, like, I'll work on this with a lot of decent players. And I'll say, I want you to try and throw a ball, but I want you to start, the hand has to start moving forward before you take a step. And it's like the most awkward, impossible thing to do. You throw a baseball, a rock, you're stepping forward as your hand's still going back.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, it's just like, what am I doing? And I think when we get away from that, is because we're trying to, there's some face stuff we're trying to manage through impact, right? That, which is important in golf, but I would rather see the sequence and then let's work on the systematic issue we have with the face.
Yeah. And we're all smiling because we just had Monty Scheinblum on last week's episode. And we talked about the same exact thing. Cause I'll literally ask people to throw a football or a baseball and I'll say, what direction is the baseball going when you start to move forward? The timing of that is almost the same as what you need to do in the golf swing as well, because almost nobody starts to go forward or rotate forward or shift forward early enough.
But
everyone, people still suck at throwing a ball. We said on that show, a lot of people still can't throw a ball very well. They step with the wrong foot, etc. But the ones who can throw a ball, they all step forward while the ball is going backward.
Right.
Anyone that can throw a ball even halfway decent,
right,
they all
and
do that.
And that is if you tell someone to throw with their left hand or someone who's never thrown anything, that is the fundamental thing they need to work. It's clear. It's like, why does this look really bad? Because they don't have that transition sequence.
Yeah.
You know, and here's, you know, I'll throw this out. This might be one of the biggest things that makes me cringe with feel versus real and good golfers telling high handicappers what to do. You know, like Jack, even though Jack never did it, people will say, you know, you can never release too early. Like, I don't know. To me, it's like I just see so many beginning golfers that have no lag. They've cast it out.
Yeah.
And it's like that's the last thing they needed to hear. Like, meanwhile, I'm sure in Jack's brain and his feelings, maybe he felt like he could never release too early. But everything else was so automated. You know, it's like someone's not aware when they throw a ball that they're stepping first.
Right.
Because it just happens. They don't even know that the lower body's doing something.
Yeah,
right?
They've done it.
So for them, hey, yeah, thinking, you know, you can never start the hand moving forward too soon. But for someone who's already doing it, that's not going to help. You know, that's something that I think feel versus real and keeps coming up in the golf industry a lot. You know, you want to get the hands down really quick. I'd be interested to have a conference because I've seen some stuff with Mont where if with the sequence, I don't know what he said on your program, this is where we would differ a little bit. He would say, you know, the timings are so subtle, he will often say, get the hands down quick. you know, to keep them out front. I'm paraphrasing a little bit. He's like, look, it goes pelvis, torso, arms that fast. But to me, that's important. So even though while you maybe can't be conscious of it, it doesn't mean you shouldn't work on it to have that sequence. You know, it might be a good feeling for someone to get the hands down quick, but that person probably already has an elite level golf swing.
So if you see a player, Sasho, that maybe doesn't have a great sequence and they're not starting with that lower body first, is there a go-to sort of training drill or program that you'll throw at them?
Yeah, I like two general models that I'll go to. I'll try to figure out if they're more like a John Rahm style tempo, or if they're more like a Jake Knapp style tempo. Those, I put those guys in the extreme ends, or maybe even we'll put one in the middle there, like that I'll have them try would be Cam Young. Or if you're not super coordinated, then it could be nice to have the full pause. And if you're fast,
right?
If you're already like swinging at 125, you got tons of potential. Be like, hey, let's try the Cam Young, because then it's like you're starting fresh. You know, like, all right, let's get the lower body going. Nice gather at the top.
Yeah.
Trying to feel a stretch, get the lower body going. But if you struggle generating speed and also you're a quick tempo Nick Price kind of guy, then you want to feel like, all right, I'm, you know, whipping the backswing back. And then while like really early, while things are like mid-flight in the backswing, then I fire the lower body. Right. It's I don't give myself time to think. It's like, hey, I want to be quick with the hands. I want to be quick and aggressive with bringing the club down. Well, then, and maybe I'm a bit of a nervous player under pressure, then I better get the lower body going super fast. Right. And then I still have the sequence in both ways. Right. But to me, the key there is the sequence. You know, you need to clear the lower body first, get that going. So does John Rahm feel a little more comfortable for you? You know, there's obviously everything in between, but I'll have them, you know, sure, think about those two patterns and see what works better. Some people, if you say, hey, let's do Cam Young, everything freezes and then it's, you've lost all the speed and everything comes down together. And that was a disaster. And other people, they just can't handle a quick tempo like John, you know, it's like someone like John Rahm. It's just not in their DNA to be a fast and aggressive swinger like that. Every time I look at John Rahm, I think, like, you know, I haven't seen him in a while. I'm like, oh, man, it's too quick. He's quick. You know, it's like he didn't finish his backswing. Oh, wait, he just flushed it. That wasn't, you know. Yeah.
So would you, if you have the stack, which hopefully you guys do, is there like for one of those tempos versus the other, would you go lightweight to get that feel and then super heavy?
I always like heavy when working on body sequencing, like lowered upper, because it forces you with a heavy club, it's going to be going back and it allows you to start down while it's still tugging you in the backswing direction. If it's specifically looking at like lag and trying to get speed out to the club, like at that last distal segment, not organizing the segments of the body, then I'll go super light. And cause you can have a terrible sequence and it's just really about that what's happening at the wrist. If you've got, you know, like 45 grams on the stack. So I like heavy for working on, you know, general stuff. It's very clear that that's the issue with most people, because it's a very common thing for stackers to reach out and say, hey, we do a step intent. And they're like, my step intent is slower than my max effort swing. So the step is still max effort, but we call it step intent versus max intent. And that step forces you to have, if you do it correctly, should have that proximal to distal transition sequence. And inevitably, I'll have someone send me a video, and they're already starting down. This is the key for me, before the lead heel plants. So when I'm thumbing through a video, if you're taking a step, as the club's going back, you take the step. I need to that lead heel, even if you don't do a step, even if you're just doing a swing where you lift the lead heel, that lead heel needs to be on the ground. The pressure isn't in the heel, right? It's still in the forefoot, but there should be no distance between the heel and the ground as those hands and club are still traveling in the backswing. And with those folks are like, hey, I swing the 195 or the 145, we'll say at 100 with max swing, and I'm at 95 with the step. you have a terrible transition sequence. Without the transition sequence going proximal and distal, you can't take advantage of the what the step provides.
That makes sense.
That's one of the reasons I think I don't love the wobbly boards, because they take so long to land that you're just like waiting forever to like make the club come down. And like good players, like I feel like they hate them. You know, I use them in short game now and then.
I like
because
that.
It's a little bit slower motion, but like for full swings, like ugh, like I'm not a fan. I've stopped using them because they just take too long to land.
It's not even pressure at that point. It doesn't even work. That's the problem. It needs to legitimately be a weight transfer, like you're saying. By that time, by the time you transfer your weight, then you haven't done it right with the pressure. I'm with you. I can never. They don't get at what I want to get at with a shift.
Yep.
You know, I mean, there might be a very high level beginning golfer. You got to feel like you finish with your weight on your front foot or something.
Right.
You know, like a sense of movement.
Yeah.
But when it comes to that refined, you know, what you need to do to generate some speed. Yeah.
Guys, anything else?
Listen, I think again.
God, I'm going to think about some as soon as we're off.
I know. My
yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. So. If we've got the light one for the lag, do you have like an actual like feel into the wrist? So for instance, like myself, I know I've sent you stuff before. It's like, I have a bad wrist from an old army injury, and it's like, I'm always trying to get something more out of it.
You have a bad everything from an old army injury.
Everything on this side is really, really bad. I had a new PT, and I was listing all the injuries, and he's like, so is there anything that isn't injured? I'm like,
yeah, I love for folks that I can see it in the data. If you have trouble getting speed out to the club, if your percentiles are really low with the lighter weights, then that means you're having trouble getting speed out to the club. You should, as the weights get lighter, you should be able to increase your speed in a predictable way. And if it doesn't increase by that amount, that's what you struggle with. It probably means you're casting. So I really like a Gary Woodland, I call it, you know, down cock. Sergio has that look. He lays the club off. So I'm not, you know, he definitely has a little bit of it. But Gary Woodland does it amazingly. And that's why the guy can swing effortlessly and generate, well, I think he's still close to 130 club head speed or something, high 129s for the season.
Yeah.
You know what? He gets this amazing stretch. So he's got the sequence in spades, you know, where maybe you could argue that you might end up sacrificing a bit of club face control. I don't know if I'm in that camp, but that would be the reason to have a more structured look. But boy, getting that stretch, you know, in that segment between the arms and the club, or, you know, at the wrist joint, is awesome for speed, right? It's, to me, it's the exact way you want to transition. It's like, hey, that wrist angle, you're adding wrist cock to get that stretch as you step forward. Just like with the baseball pitcher, you're going to see, you know, that as everything's going forward, the last thing will be, you'll still get a little bit of that, you know, as the rest of your body's moving forward. So I'll have people practice that. And the feeling will be very wide at the top. You don't want to max out your range of motion. You want to feel like you can still add range of motion in all the joints, but in particular the wrist, you know? So kind of like a J.B. Holmes type of position at the top, so that when you start down, you almost get that jackknifing at the wrist. Like the act of putting force on the grip to move in the downswing direction causes it to jackknife in. You get a stretch, and that way it's really tough to cast, right? That angle is closing, and then by the time you think, oh, I got to get rid of it, hey, it's at a great time. Now, that's
just a little float load.
Yeah, float load, exactly. Yep, a little float load. And some people will feel like, oh yeah, that was crazy, and they'll look at it in video and they'll look like Steve Stricker, right?
Yeah.
Because they're so used to casting it, that their float load looks like Steve Stricker, and they could never do Gary Woodland at all. And the great thing about stacking while you do it is that you can't fake it, because you're trying to get high speed. So you'll get that feedback. Like if you go completely limp and you don't get any stretch, it's just like there's nothing going on in the hands. The speed doesn't get out to the club. You didn't do it right. That's why having that, you know, the radar down in your speed training, you're trying to create a high speed. You can feel like, oh, that was right. You know, like I like to think of it as like Matt Fitzpatrick does this amazing. He's got magic hands. And if you ever watch his swing at the British Open this week. It's like his hands are the perfect level of tension. It's like someone just taken, they're not even muscles. They're like these springs. And he just slings that club back. They load and stretch. And then it slings out. I think if the average person, average golfer felt what he feels like, they would be completely freaked out because they would have no idea where the face is, right? The way he just slings that club around, you know?
Yeah.
Even when he's hitting precise iron shots, you're like, how do you know where the face is? You know, there's like almost no structure, right? It's the opposite of what you would think. He's like Gary Woodland, almost to the extreme. He does it more at the top than halfway down. What an amazing ability to control the face with, in my opinion, like having this awesome blend of super flexible, supple wrist action.
Well, and I think you mentioned something a couple of minutes ago where you said, you know, there's a camp out there that will sort of say that if there's too much of that, then you lose control of the club face. And there's a lot of high level players that are making that move and they can control it. Now, maybe that's not for everybody.
Yeah.
Right. But to just make that general statement, probably not, you can't just quantify that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that if you do that, you have to be very cognizant of, like, I think if John Rahm had Matt Fitzpatrick wrists, then maybe there'd be a lot of spraying of the golf ball. Maybe not, you know, but like you have to be very cognizant of how much linear hand speed you have through impact. That you have to have very precise control of that if you have limited wrist structure. You know, if your hands race through impact and you've got low tension, you know, you're very free with the hands, then that club face is staying wide open.
Yeah.
You know, that's when you get the blocks. You're like, all right, I'm going to be very loose and relaxed in the wrists, and it just stays jackknife through impact. That, you know, it's kind of what you can see when people are chipping and they blade one, you know, that the hand speed is very high. They get a little nervous. The club stays folded back and they blade it, you know, because the hand speed was too high through impact. They couldn't release it, you know?
Yeah. Yep.
So what you're saying is deceleration is okay in chipping.
Yeah, but certainly the hands have to. Yeah.
The hands have to. Yeah.
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 The amount of times I tell students that it's okay because they're like, oh, I decelerated in that. I'm like, I know that you need slightly more of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Shoving the hands makes it very tough to get the club head to do what you need it to do to generate the right loft and spin and precise ball speed. Yeah.
Yep. So, Doc, we'll get to breaking forces another time. Thanks for coming on. Where can people find anything that you want to tell us about?
Twitter. You know, Sasha McKenzie, I post a bunch of stuff on there. I'm on Instagram, and a lot of my stuff ends up coming through the Stack System. So you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter as well, or stacksystem.com, flashy new webpage. You got lots of content on there.
Doc, thanks so much for coming on. Truly appreciate it.
My pleasure, Tyson.
Yeah, and everybody out there, if you aren't stacking and if you aren't doing the new stack wedge, which is hopefully I should be able to start that this week. I saw that on there, and my buddy Hutch is up in that leaderboard. I gotta get on that myself.
You can get in there. He did a great. You know, it's awesome practice, and it's pretty darn fun. You know, seasonal circuit, summer 26, 8 weeks.
Yeah, can't wait.
Awesome. Jason, where can people find us?
So if you guys are looking for us, you can find us on all social medias at The Spin Axis or online at thespinaxis.com.
Thanks.
All right.